interesting what you're saying. You know, it's not exactly the same as, but it has all these resonances with these different sort of esoteric philosophies and stuff. It's interesting.
For example.
Well, just the what I want, what I'm doing, and what I want is becoming one, or you know, no longer trying like that. That sounds a bit like, you know, the Stoic Crowley or the things about. I know I'm not trying to say you're exactly the same as, but yeah, or the things about, you know, just realizing that everything is shot through with this, and it doesn't need to be sort of repaired because that's just how. Like that's again like that Boehme guy was talking about, or even some Buddhist stuff, but. Before you go, there's just a couple other things. One was this whole thing about gifted classes, which were really this idea from rigorous intuition that there were all these gifted classes that went from being a laboratory for psychic powers and stuff like that. And then eventually they evolved into just containers for people who would question things to just have them do whatever. And that could be an experiment on its own, or it could just be a sort of thing to.
The you mean the schools ended up as containers or the individuals?
Well, this is the question. I mean, it's like these gifted classes where if there was they were being put into this totally purposeless environment where they could just do whatever, then it means that they're being put in an environment where they are actually able to enact that philosophy you were just talking about, you know. They're put in an environment where there is no project, there is no, you know, great goal or anything of. So
So, which is the sort of this the progressive school's idea of education, getting back to the roots of the word, just to find out what's within the kids and let them explore and express what's within them.
yeah.
That which brings us back to Quakerism and their principle. So, what you're suggesting that creates a free for all in which actually the exploitation or distortion can emerge
Well,
and be channeled, or.
I'm not saying it all loops back down into the abyss. I'm just saying that, okay, if in places like North America or the UK, all these people by the 1980s or whatever, of all these gifted children who through pattern recognition tests based that are very much like these synchronicity audience cults and things. Through pattern recognition tests, like I was in a gifted class for a year or two when I was a kid. If these pattern recognition tests that aren't really intelligence tests, and that's what placed you into the gifted class. And then when you're in the gifted class, you're in this kind of unstructured, pseudo-Quaker environment. What's going on there with that containment thing? Is that just is it just a this whole thing of experimentation with the psyche elevated to a very free thing? Or, I mean, I'm not trying to say, oh, everything that the system does has to be wicked and harmful. Like, I know that it could have just been an environment for those people to experiment. But since it seems like, well, everyone posting on that forum about weird shit, a lot of them were in these environments growing up. And now they're taking this role of like genealogists and documenters of the dark underbelly of the civilizational psyche. Now we're into something interesting, you know? What the heck is going on there? It's a really interesting loop back. And then, yeah, and then I mean, what's the whole thing with the internet now, where everyone's sort of encouraged to curate their own audience cult? You know, if you think about like these younger generations of people that are growing up on like things like Tumblr or whatever, right? So it's sort of like this democratization of this, you know, free-form psychic experimentation, and it's all being metered and measured and recorded and so on. And somebody like you is really, you're kind of like, you're this the stuff you're doing is really sort of like a extreme case of it, because you're touching on so many of the things that are right at the heart of it, right?
Yeah, so I mean, what you're talking about and the overlap with the internet, these schools and all the rest of it, what I get from that, or what I what it sort of sparks in my own, current view of these things is about harnessing the psyche, essentially, that the there may only be one source of energy in the universe, and that is the psyche, let's say. Let's just throw that out there as a possible sort of axiom. So all energy is psychic energy at a certain level. And therefore that's the I don't know if you'd say the Holy Grail or what the correct term for that would be, the Ark of the Covenant, that so any and all ways in which the psyche can be observed, can be contained, can be harnessed, could be useful to something, to this unknown principle at work here, which let's just call it control.
Now,
Like
this sounds
there's some.
like a podcast, an old podcast of yours I heard from one of your old series where you're talking about these old masters that are Saturnian and they're very,
Right.
they're using everybody's kind of.
Psychic energy to create realities, yeah, which is of course the Matrix story. So yeah, something along those lines, and so, I mean, what it seems to be with these, like, I went to one of those progressive schools. I didn't stay; I only stayed a couple of months. Did have some weird experiences there, I think, because I've got these weird anomalous memories. My impression, not just from experience but from research, is that they are created with the best intentions and may even do quite a bit of good. They may be better in some ways than other schools, but
yeah.
That somehow that hide id side, because it's always present, it always ends up shaping and directing the agendas. And
yeah, there's a nexus of change going on, similar to people who are involved with psychedelics or something. It's like a lot of people who've taken all these psychedelics end up becoming these change agents, or people that have been in progressive gifted schools, even though having a day sitting in a park doing acid or being with a bunch of other kids playing freely, there's nothing scary or fucked up about that. It just means that you become more empowered, really, which could be power use.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I'm not sure about empowerment even being as a valid goal, but
yeah, I don't mean
certainly not dropping acid. But let's just bring it back to the specific example. Like, if you have a school where you encourage children to run around naked because you don't want them to develop the social shame of their own bodies, that seems really reasonable. But on the other hand, and so then you allow them to express sort of quasi or preliminary kind of sexual urges, as in exploratory. That seems all well and good, but then when you have adults there, maybe they're naked too, maybe they're not, they're observing the children, they're having emotional, psychological, perhaps even physical responses to what the children are doing. They will interpret the children's behavior and they will mirror it back. So you could have a child who's just running around naked, but if there's an adult there who sees that child and has any kind of sexual response to that, the adult will interpret what the child's doing as sexual when it isn't. And so right there you've got the beginning of a whole snowball of misinterpretation.
With that article that was posted, you have people trying to rationalize all that and say it's fine. And I don't think it's really necessarily is good because, well, I mean, for all the documentation that people like you have put together, the fact that...
Well, where it ends up,
yeah.
that's what we know. We just know it always ends badly, so...
It's in a really bad place. Like, and then, you know, all this stuff of Anne Diamond's about institutions like York University, and, okay, well, I went to York University for a year, and let me tell you, it was a place with a very weird vibe. Very much felt like it was a center for political experimentation, all this kind of manipulation and stuff like that. And it was just, the energy there was really strange. And, you know, now I'm going in the Iron Diamonds thing and I'm seeing, oh, it started by these kind of pedophilia activists and stuff like that. And it's just really, it really all was very weird. But I mean, I think what you did there, you jumped from this kind of harmless thing of just like letting kids express their creativity. And then you immediately jumped to this creepier thing of like naked kids, which is like the gifted classes didn't have naked kids. I mean, maybe you went to some kind of upper class.
No, I didn't. We didn't have naked kids. I don't remember any of that. But it was part of the progressive school thing, some of them.
Yes, I read about that.
I mean, it wouldn't be able to do it now, or at least not for a while. But anyway, I was just using that as a much more clear example. But you could also extend it to creative expression. You have children just expressing themselves, and it may start as pure and innocent, whatever you want to call it, unencumbered by sort of social baggage. But if the adults there see it, they see it through their own conditioned eyes, and they congratulate a child and encourage them to feel special, and things that maybe seem perfectly harmless are not. But the underlying point is that as always, is the unconscious. If, you know, people can have the best intentions of the world, and they're not aware of that. There is that hide that's just waiting to come out.
Yeah, so it's sort of like, I guess, to bring it back to this thing of gifted classes, it could be You have like these educators that want. I mean, you could have a there could have you could have a whole bunch of different angles on why that environment is being propagated. And I mean, you could have like educators that really believe, oh, people become more intelligent and they become more conscious of their abilities and how to use them when they're given this kind of freedom to develop their creativity. And then you also could have people that are working for things like the military-industrial complex or something that are saying, oh, well, this is the perfect environment for many multifaceted and experimentation that, and observation, even that can go in many ways, sort of like how the internet, if you have the internet where people can express everything, then, you know, that's the perfect, if there's a domain where people are allowed to say everything, do everything, that's the perfect medium for observation and analysis and experimentation. But then
Yeah.
to develop people who are willing to do, right, to develop the NSA agents or whatever, then you have to have these institutions that are like the flip side of that, right? Like the Mormon church, where they control, you know, the underwear you're wearing and everything. And then those are the people that end up being the functionaries in this intelligence apparatus. And then, you know, there's that weird psychotic split between the two sides.
Right, and that's that polarization pendulum thing again. How do you control a society? You constantly keep it swinging, and you constantly create environments or allow environments to emerge that are one extreme or the other, and then they will actually work together, you know, consciously or unconsciously. They will sustain each other in this way. So, I mean, what's going on now? So much now with Jan Irvin and Co. about the 60s counterculture being a psyop. I mean, this has become a counter narrative now, so many people are aware of it. So, and it makes perfect sense when you look at it, how, you know, the acid revolution, all the rest of it, seemed to be a swing of the pendulum. You know, it went from the 50s to the 60s and then back to the 80s, right? You can see the pendulum swinging there.
And now we're gonna, I feel like we're in this thing where there's a pendulum that's going to swing from third wave feminism and hypersexual stuff to this sort of thing of people saying, well, we reject all sexuality, or perhaps even more dark than that, you know, maybe like this thing of persecuting people for their sexuality again or something, but or even the other extreme of like really like bad stuff happening with people arguing that no, we should be having sex with children, and then that whole rabbit hole that opened up in the 70s and stuff like that. One thing I think Anne Diamond might have touched on, I mean, are you familiar with that guy, Kevin Annett?
Yeah, he was on Stormy Weather.
Okay. Because, you know, when we were talking about like the Enlightenment and stuff like that, you know, I mean, like the whole Indian or Native residential school system, which I've known a couple people where their families, you know, were involved in that. I still even studied it in school, right? And like the whole official story of it was, we're going to make the indigenous people into the enlightened subjects, and then the reality obviously was this thing of like genocide, abuse, torture, and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think they were expendable, was my guess. The natives were kind of the expendable subjects for MK Ultra,
Yeah, but
as opposed to rich white kids and whatnot,
yeah, no,
which
of
obviously
course
has.
there's the racism and the disparity there, but I mean, the official story nonetheless was that we're going to make these indigenous, like back, I'm going back to the 19th century now, right? We're going to make these indigenous people into Westerners, basically.
Right.
And now, like, obviously, very sad, all this stuff. Then you have somebody like Kevin Annett, who, to me, my impression of Annett is that he started out trying to document it in a genuine and sincere way, and then he was subjected to some kind of harassment to the point where he broke down and he just became very much a caricature of what he was before.
That's been my impression too, although I haven't actually listened to him in the last few years, so I
Me
can't.
neither. I mean, I actually came across this stuff 10 years ago when I was a teenager, because now we're back to the whole thing that, you know, many people talk about a rigorous intuition. I never would have thought of giving any of this stuff a smidgen of thought if it weren't for 9/11, and that being this obvious cognitive dissonance that made me sort of dig in, right? But which then goes into the mass trauma ritual and all this stuff, and like, what role are me and you playing right now? Just trying to talk about or document this stuff doesn't mean I'm not willing to do it, but still. But yeah, like the whole thing with in residential schools and stuff like that, you know, really horrible genocidal thing. But then, you know, if we're talking about the next 50 years on a planetary level, you know, there's obviously going to be this drive to like upgrade everyone to quasi-transhuman subjects or whatever, and then what kind of atrocities are going to be the byproduct of that? I mean, I don't really want to speculate about it here right now with you, but what kind of awareness do you see of that basic problem? I mean, I don't see a ton of awareness and discussion about it. I see people with like black humor and kind of people who don't want to talk about it, which goes back to the whole thing of like people like my mother on any of these subjects. I shouldn't ever be bringing them up with it, right? But occasionally stuff has come up and she's always just like, yeah, we don't know anything about any of this. We should never talk about it. And then now we're into differentiation from the mother where I'm like seeing it as like separating myself from her by looking at it, which is probably a sick thing for a man to be thinking anyways.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that if you're going to bring it to that, then that's bringing it down to some sort of experiential thing, and that may be the most essential thing is for people to individuate from their mothers and finish, complete that process of landing in the body, and all the rest is irrelevant. However, seeing as you did bring up the transhumanist thing, and not even specifically that, but you're touching on it earlier, like the way that we're being, having our thoughts policed and corrected, is very interesting to me. The first Limitless podcast was about that, so it's kind of the theme of the Limitless, one of them, that, and I observed this, I think it was a real situation, that the way that that works, the thought correction, is that, and this I think is the real intrusion now, the real, I don't want to say danger, it's just happening, but the thing to be aware of. The way that it works is that we forget, once our thoughts have been corrected, we forget that we could even think any differently. So we're not actually noticing, I mean, most people are not noticing the changes that are happening, not really. They notice them, and then they are changed by them, or in congruent with the changes happening, they are subtly or not so subtly coerced or bullied into going along with the changes and accepting them, and then they even forget that the change has happened in a sense. And I'm not talking about the physical technological changes, obviously that's all on record, but in terms of what's the right way to think, or what's, I don't even know what the word is. What were you going to say?
Just stuff like the Cultural Revolution in China, or you know, the Soviet Union, or like the whole residential school thing is a more extreme example of it in Canada. Like, you have whole cultures that are cut off from their memory and stuff like that.
Right. Right. So that's a very extreme case. Yeah. But it is happening to us. See, I mean, it is happening to the supposed dominant.
Even the spread of Christianity in you know, early Christianity, and saying, oh no, we need to destroy, no more paganism, no more, none of these records. I guess, you know, that was a process that happened over a long time. I mean, certainly you had the burning libraries and stuff like that.
So this is interesting in relation to mind control, because I was hearing a lecture recently about how, you know, allegedly, and this is partly a cover story, but it's still relevant, the CIA became interested in mind control when they saw the Moscow show trials and how Stalin had managed to get his former enemies not just to admit to crimes they didn't commit, but to beg to be executed.
That's what Orwell is writing about, I guess. Before, like, wasn't Orwell writing about that before the MKUltra people would have used that as a justification?
I don't know. I mean, Orwell's, he wrote in 1948, and he meant it to be, he didn't mean it as science fiction. He was going to call it 1948. So he was talking about what he saw and knew and turned it into a metaphor. So
I
that was about
seen articles this, that Orwell was assassinated because he, for all kinds of reasons. I don't know enough about the whole back.
Yeah, I wouldn't start going down that rabbit hole. But to bring it back to what I was saying, I didn't finish it, was that for a dominant culture or an institution or a party or whatever we want to call that, for a power base, if you want to defeat the opposition, it's much more effective to convert them. If you just destroy them, then that the energy of the opposition remains present. They become martyrs, even potentially. If you can convert them, as Stalin managed, and get them to not just confess to being guilty, but align themselves with the state to the extent that they actually want to die, you know, because of their own shame and guilt, then you've completely, the Borg has completely assimilated that, whatever that was.
Stalin did it with a lot of brutality, but have you ever heard of like Gene Clark or any of these people?
Not Gene Clark.
I think, was that his name? I don't know if that's actually his name. It's something like that. I think it is Gene Clark, but he's like a guy who works for all these think tanks in America, right? Like Harvard and stuff. And he's talking, writing all these books. I've read some of them because so many people have talked about them in this context, and they're all about how do we use soft power to bring about that change in people. So instead of
Right.
torturing or shooting people in the head and stuff, how do we get them to do it just with very, very soft, mild forms of persuasion, much like you'd see in a, now we're back to like the Quaker Church and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I would think that would depend on some sort of brutality in the very early stages. So if somebody is traumatized at birth, as most of us were in the Western world, probably all of us, then that would, I mean, if somebody's already dissociated and fragmented, then I think there's probably a much more room for more subtle coercive methods as opposed to the more violent. So I think that may be true.
Since you're talking about forgetting, I think there's a form of forgetting too, where like a certain kind of co like we retain a certain kind of coherence, but it loses its meaning and context into in relation to the deeper context. I mean, that's what like if you're talking right now about transhumanism and stuff, it's like, I mean, I think on that, I think there were some people talking about, oh, are we stuck in time that's not really moving because popular culture and things like that seem sort of static. Well, it's like, yeah, we do. I mean, in a place like North America, okay, there has been all this, there's been changes, but there's been a lot that's just sort of remained the same for a while now, but its meaning in relation to the deeper context is changing. So it doesn't feel like we're forgetting because we are keeping this unbroken continuity with the past, but it's, there's a kind of forgetting that's happening in terms of like, well, it's losing its meaning or its relevancy.
The change in context and even the removal of context. So in the example of transhumanism, the obvious context that's being removed to me is that of the psyche and the unconscious, because if you put transhumanism, Ray Kurzweil and all that in the context of Freud, it doesn't make any sense. It's just a demented fairy tale, really.
Well, I mean, almost seems that the people who are working on it, I mean, wasn't it true that one of the biggest AI scientists out there wrote that thing, I forget what it's called, but saying, well, there's going to be a war between the Terrans and Cosmists. There's going to be this whole idea that biological humans have to create a first strike against a transhumanist, you know, super-empowered artificial intelligence, and that this will kind of.
Right. So that's like the psyche body wars, the psyche soma wars,
Totally.
extended outward.
It's crazy. It's like this is the guy who's working to build the superhuman machine intelligence, and he's saying you people should be fighting it, but he's still.
Which guy?
I forget his name. He was a European guy, I think, that works in China now. But all you have to search for is the Terran Cosmist War.
Oh, well, that's interesting if he's saying that. You're saying that he's saying that he's encouraging people to fight the thing that he's
Which
promoting.
again would be a way for getting more protection for it and for making it evolve faster because the
Yeah,
European scientists
reinforcing.
and sure the Western governments want to build these things for deterrence purposes and that kind of crazy Dr. Strangelove type logic. So, way to get more money and attention for it would be to get people to attack it and your controlled opposition almost. And, wow.
Okay, so where were we? The context.
Oh, that was the forgetting and, you know, the fact that things are like it doesn't seem like we're forgetting as much as we're really forgetting because we're just kind of repeating this cultural stuff, but it like when once it all becomes mediated by, you know, smartphones and this stuff that's sort of like phase one of the transhumanist, mass transhumanist, whatever, then it's like, okay, we're still watching the same movies being remade, we're still have the same fantasies of the life we want to live, you know, but it's now being mediated by this other layer. So, we're just like, we're forgetting why we wanted to do it because we haven't, since we're just repeating the same sort of culture, we've, that means that we haven't really yet created a response to the new technological layer and what we want from it because we're not allowed to create a response to that or what we want from it.
Well, there's something about technology and how it creates its own agendas. It instills in us new desires that we wouldn't have had if that technology didn't exist. And that, so those desires, in a sense, you could say they don't really come from us, they come from the technology itself. Well, they could, of course, you say that we created the technology, so there was some unconscious desire that was working there, perhaps. But I don't know, technology is fascinating to me. It's becoming more and more fascinating, and also more and more, I'm seeing more and more how it can be applied to so much. Like, I'm talking about art now as technology, language is a form of technology. In a sense, it's like everything is technology when the psyche and the body are split, because the body itself becomes technology, really. Like, if there's just the psyche living in the body, it's just one thing. Well, that, like I say, in a way, that's complete unto itself,
Yeah, well, I mean, that's
really.
what, have you ever heard of the whole thing of Martin Heidegger's about the standing reserve or the question concerning the essence of technology, that essence he wrote, or that essay he wrote where he's saying, the technological mode being or modernity says that everything is viewed as just a reserve of resources to be infinitely reappropriated in this plastic way, and it's all made equivalent by that.
Right.
And,
So yeah, so that would, I don't, I'll let you finish if you've got more to say, but just quickly, that would relate to the psyche that wasn't landed in the body, because it would be constant, and the body that wasn't ensouled, it would be constantly feeling a lack. It would be constantly trying to fill up that vacuum.
yeah, well, I think I read a really, like, I actually wrote a whole thing about how, well, you could just use that model and you could see, oh, well, other ways, other forms of existence will jut through that form of existence. Like, if you try to control the Earth's weather, and then you find out that all of your models and all of your plans and all of your objectives don't really work out and everything starts fucking up, then you're going to have to say, well, it doesn't really do justice to the planet to view it as just a object for our manipulation. We have to come to a new way of understanding it. And I think that that step is really missing from this whole proto-transhumanist thing that's being pushed on us right now, because it's, I think there's all this stuff going on. Like, if you look at, like, North America right now, there's all this, these symptoms of, like, okay, well, these people can't really cope with this technological mediation that's being foisted on them. Maybe we need to do some more, maybe we need to be a little bit more conscious of what should be going on with us as people. I mean, I'm not talking about what the planners or the controllers should be thinking about. I mean, we all should be coming up with a response to this new level of mediation and what we really want from it, and how we could have a different interaction with it. But just wanting that change or wanting that response to the technological mediation puts us in this thing that's now this sort of, like, incipient, forbidden category of, like, hackers, right? It's like people who want to repurpose this whole level of information technology are becoming a sort of terrorist.
Right.
I mean, that's where I see our society going right now. I mean, not just repurpose it in terms of re-engineer it, but people who want to really comment on the political meaning of it and on the effects it's having on people socially. I think that's being, like, we're on the road to seeing that become, like, a form of hate speech or just very much, not correct way of thinking. And I'm sure you've heard about the thing in China, right, of, like, the social credit system, where you have a series of points based on how good thinking a person you are, really. And it's similar to a credit rating in the West. I mean, there's a thing they're rolling out.
No, I haven't heard
It's
about
all the
that.
social media, like, everything we have here that's separately, email and Twitter and Facebook, it's all synthesized into one application in China now. And it evaluates you, and it gives you essentially a social credit rating, which is like a credit rating, but instead of being for money and debt, it's a rating of how much responsibility you should be given in the society based on your actions on a social media integrated platform.
Wow. So, am I a good person? Am I a bad person? Let's check the stats
It's a number,
today.
yeah. It's a very, I mean, it's just like hyper, acceleration of all this stuff.
as this is relevant, as this will tie up with what you just said, but again, in the conversation I was having yesterday, I was talking about Christians and how it is that they can end up as Satanists in their private time, which does seem to be the case. And actually, in relation to this, hopefully I'll finish the whole point. Stephen Kent, the sociologist, when he looked into satanic ritual abuse over the years, I didn't know he had. I just knew him through his involvement with John DeRuyter, investigating that. But anyway, he couldn't understand how it was that all these different testimonies included similar elements, unless it was an entirely organized worldwide thing, and he found that too difficult to believe. And then it occurred to him that they were creating their rituals independently of each other, these groups, by referring to the Bible. And they were simply finding all the things that were forbidden in the Bible and creating rituals around them. And I think this is a pretty good theory, and it's probably, I mean, he certainly backed it up with evidence. And so I was bringing that up because it was occurring to me yesterday that if you're a Christian, you believe that there's this God watching everything you do, right? And they've said, Peter Watts talked about this on the podcast, that if they draw a pair of eyes on the wall in a classroom, people are less inclined to cheat. Even the sort of superstitious idea that we're being watched will cause us to behave more self-consciously and even, let's say, ethically, in terms of a socially sanctioned idea of ethics, right? But if you add to that, and it's inevitable, you have to have this factor that the God that is lovingly watching over you, if you're a Christian, has the power to send your soul to hell for all eternity for doing something wrong that you may not know is wrong until you've done it, therefore it's too late. The kind of pressure that would create in the psyche is going to intensify the id to such an extent that it's going to take control, it's going to possess that person, I think. I mean, it seems to me that there's a combination of things that these groups that are performing these horrendous rituals and acts, and I'm trying to relate this to your thing about China eventually, but is that a combination of the fact that they feel damned already, that there's no way you can win with a God who's, who's so contradictory and unpredictable and impossible to understand. So they try, they hang out with Christians and try to be good, but it's impossible, because it's just you can't rationally control your behavior in such a way that you can guarantee you won't go to hell, when the fear of hell is just, and the idea of hell is so irrational, right? You can't use an irrational belief system to create rational behavior around. So then what happens is that a combination of that feeling of not being good enough, it being impossible to be good enough, with finding people who have rejected the program and are going the other direction, saying, fuck it, I'm damned, I might as well enjoy it, whatever. Then there's a safety in that, as well as the relief of, well,
oh, and you think you can see,
nobody's judging me, that's it. If there's no God, I'm the only God, I create my own rules. But at the same time, you've got a social environment in which that's condoned, it's no longer evil. I mean, when the burden of goodness is so heavy, and when the rules of it, or the terms of it, are so arbitrary, which is this thing with China, and basically it just comes down to numbers in social media. You could see how that would intensify a pathology that was already present to create these systems of repression to begin with.
Sure, but I just want to say, and then you're just immediately making me think of, in North America, there's this extreme, for educated people, so there's this extreme guilt about privilege and all this stuff, and it gets to a point where it's just like that Christian thing you're saying, where then it becomes, well, everything's permitted because we're so bad that there's no getting out of the hole of how bad we are.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, an interesting thing made me think of, the witch hunts and the position where it's Malleus Maleficarum was this whole witchcraft ritual these Catholic priests were doing, from what I gather, where they were saying, well, we need to use witchcraft to exterminate witchcraft.
Right.
And then that just makes me think of the stuff going on in Middle East right now, where they're saying, we need to use this, extreme brutality to create a just society. And
Yeah, and the thing at Red Ice and John Lash and that whole thing of we need to destroy all the psychopaths in order to be able to live good, wholesome lives.
Horrible kind of mirroring, like the René Girard mirroring thing.
Yeah, Mimesis.
And it's with the whole thing about, well, all these people just generated it spontaneously from the Bible, I don't doubt that that did happen, but I also think we can't discount the fact that there might be manipulators who are aware of that dynamic. I mean, they talk about it explicitly, right?
Well, it may have even been
And
part of the intention behind writing or rewriting the Bible.
in the first place, I think so, definitely. Because when we talk about all these gurus of like Western occultism and stuff, or tantrists or something like that, I mean, they're explicitly saying, you know, create these systems where you break every rule and then from that you create the rules for others to follow or something like that.
Right, break every, yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. So the system, the Guardian, sustains itself. Pendulum again. It's constantly breaking the taboos, but then it creates new
It
taboos.
seems like there's one class of people who are just, you know, they're driven to break it just because of the inner futility of the system itself, which might be true of some of this Christian stuff, and then the other level of
Right.
manipulation where they're conscious of setting up that whole dynamic, which is probably a symptom of an even deeper kind of traumatic programming, you know.
Right. So yeah, it's the negative identity, as I was saying earlier. If you're individuating just through breaking taboos rather than actually that just being a means to an end of letting the id express and integrating the id, if you're fixated on the taboos, you will have to keep creating new taboos, otherwise you'll run out of taboos and then you'll be all adrift. You won't be able to maintain that negative identity any longer. So, and this, I mean, this is one of the questions about or criticism or whatever, counter arguments to the idea they're normalizing sex with children, because if it's a tool for blackmailing those in power and controlling them, they wouldn't have that tool anymore if it became normalized. But of course, the things that the people in power are doing to children is far worse than just having sex with them, as we know. So there's quite a long way that we could go with normalizing taboos and making them not taboos.
It's always a
While still having taboos left, right? And even there, once you get, I mean, you could just keep creating new taboos, and it could end up completely inverted, where, like in Brave New World, if you cradle a child and are loving with it, that becomes taboo. That's somehow considered, that's traumatic because they've got to be evolutionary engineered to be supermen and etc. You know, who knows
there's an
what might be a taboo?
article in the Globe and Mail. It's saying a couple holding hands or holding an arm around each other is a form of abusive patriarchal domination and stuff like that.
Right.
So that's, you know, whatever the validity of that, I mean, it sounds a little bit like what you're just talking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing about forgetting again. Like, we break down old ways of being or we reject them, but we immediately forget we've done so, because if we didn't, we would have to recognize that the new values that we've replaced them with might equally be rendered invalid tomorrow. Like, if we remember how we just keep changing the
Well, I
rules,
think it's going on in North America right now with this, you know, there's these two waves. Like this is one wave of like extreme demands for justice, really, and reparation for like all this racism and stuff. And then there's this other wave of, you know, extreme racism and you know, restatement of like, you know, people who want sort of ethnically pure states and all this kind of like neo-Nazi stuff. And I mean, from what I can see, it appears that like, you know, these government institutions are manipulating both sides of that. That's that level that's aware again. So if we're going back to your whole myth about these old masters that are aware of all these dynamics and they use everyone's sort of libidinous energy as kind of this catalyst or food, what created those entities and why are they so
Well, right,
dangerous?
exactly. So, I mean, I think you can map the effects, but if you start naming effects causes, then you get stuck in this duality thinking, and you end up with an enemy and something to blame.
Maybe it's just a fractal where those people are sort of avatars of like an extreme
No,
group.
yeah, well, it's fragmentation. So if it's, oh gosh, I'm not even sure I want to try and correct that model, because it's so metaphorical that, and even fragmentation, of course, is metaphor. I mean, I don't know how literal the fragmentation of the psyche is, because I don't know what the constitution of the psyche is. I don't suppose anyone does, except maybe these old seers. Okay, to bring it more to an experiential thing, and I'm sure it is as above, so below, like, what controls the people who control the governments and the agencies and all the rest of it?
When you're talking about,
And how, sorry, let me finish, how we are able to be controlled is emotions. Like what I experienced at Rigorous Intuition, and it's just a magnification of what I've become more and more aware of, is people are not arguing with reason or with logic. They're not even really arguing. They're expressing emotions, and then they're reinterpreting their emotions and reframing them as opinions, and then the opinions get reframed as facts, and then the facts get laid down as truth. Like this guy RI that I won't name, but you mentioned him. All it is emotional venting, posing as argumentation, and that you could say that's true of all of these movements, all of the social, you know, everything really. People are driven by poisons in their unconscious, to use that term again, then the way that those poisons become known to them is as these very strong emotions that demand some kind of expression and release. And so then they'll come up with ways of behavior, ways of thinking, ideologies, policies, you know, prescriptions, all the rest of it, that just relieve the emotional attention in their own psyches. And that's how we're being farmed, you know. I mean, you can posit the other some group or some entity that is siphoning off the emotions, maybe so, but maybe it's just egregore is the word, I don't use very often, whatever, you know, a coagulation or conglomeration, a Borg-like thing of all those disowned emotions. Maybe it's just us.
Yeah, that's sort of what I lean towards, honestly. I mean, obviously there are people at the high peaks of it, but I lean towards what you're saying. Like, it sounds to me almost like this idea of the old seers, which almost sounds like a David Icke thing or something, but it's just a figure of speech for the peaks in these, before the valleys, of these kind of concentrations of this dynamic. And they're constantly being restated.
Well, I mean, it's fragmentation is that, you know, emotions, like we ourselves may be fragments, we're certainly expressing through a fragment if we're not fully individuated. So it may be that part of this, and this is MK Ultra as well, is creation of multiple personalities, that a fragment of the psyche, or even, you know, a very intensified emotional pattern, can disconnect so much that it can become autonomous and then become sentient in some way and experience itself as a whole individual being. So, I mean, at that point, all bets are off, right? We really don't know. All we know is the body. The body is there, and then there's something that inhabits it and that animates it, but we don't know what. We don't know how much we're possessed, how much we're fragmented. We don't know what it's like to be a whole psyche in a whole body.
Yeah.
Most of us. I don't.
Last topic I wanted to bring up is this whole issue of like magic, right? Because it sounds like you've swung back on the pendulum yourself a bit from a kind of radical rejection of all sorts of esotericism to now you're saying, oh, well, I guess my philosophy that I'm using to navigate or trace the, you know, the underbelly of all this stuff ends up being kind of, you can't really divorce it from these sorts of occult philosophies about the whole becoming self-conscious and things like that.
Well, I mean, if you think of Freud as an occultist, he wasn't really. He was anti, but Jung certainly was. So there's no line between psychology and occultism, really. I mean, they overlap, right?
Then with this whole thing of magic, like if it really is possible through, I guess a vulgar, like a crude way of stating it would be like through quantum effects or whatever, if it really is possible that we are in this chaotic universe where we're just like these tuning forks that can manipulate a reality in basically any direction, that would be the ultimate sort of thing of like that liminal state, right? Like this whole thing that I know you said you're not really that interested in talking about it, but this whole thing that somebody like the Gordon White Rin Soup guy is talking about of like, oh, we're all just tuning forks that can go off in any chaotic direction, and we can alter reality with our intentions and all this kind of magical, esoteric stuff. That would almost be like the epitome of this kind of liminal state that then becomes the sacrificial scapegoat. And that's why we, like, I don't think human cultures have ever really been, like, at least the ones in recorded history, they've never really, like, magic has never been something for everyone. Or, I mean, if we're talking about modernity, there's this whole thing with there's this whole weird realm of high weirdness and what's really going on behind all this obfuscation around quantum physics, physicists and do the elites really have some ability to manipulate reality with their minds? There's some technology that bridges that gap.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still on the fence about
Me
that. I
too.
mean, my own experiences suggest that certainly there's some kind of weird stuff that can happen there with an overlap. But, I mean, when you talk about the scapegoat, remember the scapegoat is what keeps the community together. So that may be well be part of the program is to create these supposed tuning forks so that they can be scapegoated and that they do keep bind the community together.
Yes.
Because I recognize that psychism has some reality. What I don't recognize, in fact, what I reject wholly, is that it has any correlation with psychic wholeness. That a person with psychic abilities is not more whole, I would say, but less whole than your average person.
Well, there's definitely a dissociation going on there, but I mean, I guess what, like, I know, and I agree with what you were just saying about the scapegoats, the people who are those people who have developed this, but like the survivors or victims of mind control. But I also think, wouldn't the whole ban in like modern civilization, the whole ban on delving into all those things, right, with the skeptic foundations and the ridicule, the basic principles of the establishment science, at least exoterically saying there's nothing to any of that, wouldn't the whole ban on it be kind of like a taboo seal on that container, on that whole liminal state that's embodied by the interaction with those forces?
Well, and that would make it more attractive. Is that your point?
Well, it would make it attractive for people, but it would also just be like, sure, people who are dabbling in that stuff or doing these kind of practices, it doesn't actually make them whole, but just completely divorcing ourselves from it and putting it off limits also doesn't make us whole.
No, and of course not, because then you're creating that arbitrary arrangement that has to be protected like a fortress. So, but there's a difference between being open to and even exploring in the sense of looking into and experimentation, right? So my view about, let's use the example of LSD, is that part of the way that it was sold to people, these liminal beings or these now known as psychonauts who wanted to discover the spiritual reality, was by outlawing it. I mean, first of all, it was touted as this great thing through the various different media programs, but then or simultaneously it was also outlawed, and that kind of legitimized it in the view of those anomalous people in society. And my view is that those are the people who benefited the least from LSD. Those are the people who would naturally have discovered their own psychic reality, their own sense of what's real, their own ground, and began to express or transmit a genuine soul transmission. If they'd simply lived relatively ordinary lives, they would have awoken spontaneously. But they were drawn and lured into this easy way to kind of assuage the tension of that anomalousness, and into audience cultures where they wouldn't feel anomalous, and so that neutralized that awakening. On the other hand, I would say the mass of people who might benefit from LSD, because it would shake them up so much they wouldn't be able to just lose themselves in the group mind, they were effectively discouraged from experimenting.
Yeah, and it's almost like there's a context that's developed where, I mean, people that are drawn to these forbidden domains in such a way that, you know, there's all this sort of like legislation and there's a whole control system around it. And
it's around
made off limits so no one will do it. It's made off limits so that people will be able to be funneled into it for a particular
reason. Yeah, and they'll do it. A certain type of person will do it, and they'll also do it in a certain context
where they don't develop as a person by doing it. It just, you know.
Well, I wouldn't want to make such a sweeping statement, but it's taboo for one thing. So I mean that, you know, I remember when I first smoked my first cigarette outside my father's house. I was about, I don't remember, about 10 or something, and it was a menthol cigarette. It was at my stepmother's, and I got a hard on while I was smoking it.
Yeah,
and I had no idea why. It was just so exciting to me, committing this taboo act. And I did become a smoker, and I'm no doubt it was partly because of that, right? So, and that, but actually, that, you know, smoking tobacco was hacking into my life force, and you know, I didn't have that much to spare. I wasn't, you know, I was traumatized birth and all the rest of it. So, you know, I have chronic fatigue for half my life, and smoking tobacco certainly exacerbated that. So, but it gave me a momentary sense of power and of life force, and so then I was hooked from then on, I guess. I mean, not literally, I didn't start smoking the next day, but that was my first experience of it. And so it being taboo did create this context. It was completely artificial. You know, in a native society, tobacco is used medicinally and blah, blah, blah. I don't necessarily mean that makes it good. I don't necessarily believe that. But still, it's a completely different context. It wouldn't just be done for recreational, nor would people get a kick out of it.
But I mean, I guess what's interesting is, like, if we have this, like, I guess the present day Western society is starting to inch into this new paradigm where it is acknowledging, oh, magic and psychic effects are real and stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's not that new.
Wait, but I mean, like, you had all the stuff in the 70s, right, where they were trying to mainstream those ideas, but you still had an official story that there was no evidence for it.
Right, and you think that's changing now?
Well, it is changing, because now you have these intellectuals or physicists or philosophers or whatever who are saying, we can't just write off consciousness as a fiction, and it actually does have panpsychic effects, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Well, I haven't noticed this. I mean, I think one thing that's maybe happening is that as we're discovering or inventing, or at least claiming to have the technology that can recreate, or for the skeptics, create for the first time, seemingly psychic phenomena, then that obviously is going to throw into question all of the skeptical views that, you know, if it's possible with technology, maybe it was always possible organically, or, well, what's the difference at this point, right?
Well, then, sounds a bit like the stuff, or sorry, it's segueing into a bit into the stuff I was talking to you about the first time I talked to you this way, where it's like, in the 20th century, all this stuff about UFOs, you know, it sort of almost seemed like it was like a treasure trove of evidence of the impossible, you know? And like, it seems like, you know, in the 20th century, there was this official position that magic didn't exist. And then there was also this whole UFO cult thing, which is very much one of those funnels used where anyone who became interested in it was then subject to surveillance and manipulation and mind control through these different apparatuses, UFO lobbyist organizations and false prophets and stuff like that.
Well, you know, I think people will believe anything, or they'll be more willing to believe anything that gives them hope, and they will be less willing to believe anything that doesn't offer hope or that destroys the hope that they have. And that this is, to me, that's where the truth is, and that's where the ground is, you know. Not that anything that reduces your levels of hope is necessarily true, but anything that is true is going to cancel out all the false hopes that we have created for ourselves, whether it's psychism, whether it's heaven, you know, whether it's the engineering the perfect poet, singer, you know, whether it's artistic success, you know, whatever values that have propped up the ideologies that prop up the culture, etc., etc., etc. Those are arbitrary values, and so I guess that's my truck with magic, just with anything else, you know, if it's offering this false hope, then I don't trust it.
So do you think with all these like liminalist conversations you're doing, do you feel like it's your hope for them would be that they're like a way to mediate all this stuff going on in the world, or kind of talk about it without any expectation that you're going to deal with it once and for all?
I was wondering about that when we talked earlier about my role and our role with this conversation, like what is happening through this podcast and what do I hope is happening, kind of thing. And I don't want to say something I've already said, like about connecting to people, that is it. I mean, something is happening. Like I was feeling the other day, in the midst of being triggered by not having my emails answered and feeling like I was actually stonewalled in some way, in the midst of that, partly due to the interaction of rigorous intuition, I was feeling like I'd made it in a weird way. I mean, it was a weird feeling, and it was weird because it had nothing to do with book sales or, you know, major exposure. It was to do with the kind of feedback I was getting.
The kind of voice you were giving to certain ideas, or letting certain ideas play off each other that were just sort of like before they'd been in contact with each other, but not really like the sparks flying in the same way or something?
Well, yeah, and that, so that what if I'm putting things together in my own life and in my own psyche, my own perceptions, and bringing coherence to my own existence, of course that is deeply satisfying in and of itself, and that's the main goal, I suppose. But if it's being echoed by others, if voices are piping up around what I'm doing, not just saying, hey, you're really great, because actually that doesn't count for that much, it just, you know, you just need it again the next day, but they're building on what I'm doing, or they're riffing off it, and they're discovering things themselves, and they're coming back at me not with praise or support in the, you know, superficial sense, but with actual something to contribute, participation, then that is deeply validating for me. I just think something's happening there that isn't necessarily about an audience cult. Like, I can't stop an audience cult happening. I can't tell people I'm not that great, don't think I'm intelligent. It doesn't work, of course. All the good, bad gurus say, you know, it's not me, it's what's coming through me, blah, blah, blah. You can't. There's no way to actually stop people from doing that if they're going to do it around you. The only thing you can do is actually work on your own way of expressing that doesn't allow for that. Like, so it's genuine humility, which of course can't be spoken because then it becomes arrogance. And I do feel genuinely humble in the sense that I don't feel like I'm doing anything except exploring stuff with people. And then I love putting it as, you know, the artwork and all the rest of it. I love having a kind of product. I enjoy being a little factory. But it doesn't feel to me like it's a ministry or something like that, which in the past was always what I was trying to do. It feels like it's a sort of water hole people come to and they drink at, and then they, you know, they're in the workplace where the cooler is, people always hang out socially there. Not that I've ever had that experience.
I enjoyed listening to your old stuff, like the Stormy Weather one, but there is a better vibe with these new ones where it is like a little bit more open-ended. It's a little bit more like those gifted class streams you're talking about. So if there's this weird overlap between entities like a gifted classroom, Quaker churches, and audience cults. And if this overlap isn't just going on with someone like you, but it's going on in this like democratic mass worldwide scale with everyone, then do you think like your hope would be that that kind of those entities don't become just sort of egregores for where people are putting all their eggs in one basket, is this is going to be our all our hopes, is going to realize all our hopes. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I would. I mean, I don't think that you need to bring hope into it. I mean, I would hope that wouldn't happen, but that's a negative hope anyway. So, what was I going to say there? That, I mean, I don't have a hope for something to happen. Outside of me, let me put it that way. I don't. I mean, I do have these hopes. I want a bestseller, even, but I don't put stock in the hopes of for anything to happen outside of me. My hope, my deepest and only hope, the only hope that really counts, is to become embodied, to become fully embodied, and to experience life, existence, myself as it truly is in this life before I die. That's it. That's my hope. And yeah, I kind of hope that doing this podcast helps me to reach that goal, of course, otherwise I'm barking up the wrong tree. So then I would hope that there's a ripple down effect for others, because that's an echo that confirms my own transmission, etc., etc. But the basic hope is what I just described, for that embodiment to happen, to find the water in the desert, and for a community, my own soul community, me, to spring up around that water hole.
Okay, well, is there anything else you want to mention? Do you think we should just leave it there?
I was thinking that's where I'll put the music
Yeah.
at that
Well, hey, that was even better than last time I talked to you. That was a really good conversation.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
That's the end of my conversation with Random Dude. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank people who have given donations through PayPal over the past several months, and therefore all the wheels of the liminal train. Specifically to Albert, Dominic, Patty, Leonard, Maria, Jesse, Paul, Michael, Stephen, Pamela, John, Elizabeth, and James. And apologies if I've forgotten to mention you. It's great, keep it coming. Makes a lot of difference to my morale and other things too. This is the Liminalist. You've now listened. Go about your business and be healed.
La jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Des lèvres, l'air de bois, tout pour se des problèmes. Les songes sur les arbres préparent mon beaucoup. Ils sont des armes nocibles de destruction massive.
Thank you. you, monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his word came